Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to another episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. We are getting ready for part two of a three-part series on the best athlete by number for the New York sports teams. I'm Dan Newman. I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Newman. And Andrew, looking forward to getting into this again tonight.
Yeah, me too, Dan. It was we just recently posted the first part of it, so I listened to some of that for the first time. It's kind of like a refresher because it was probably about a month ago that we did the first part of it. We're not recording this all in one marathon session and breaking it into different episodes. But yeah, the first one of these was a lot of fun, so I'm assuming this one will be too.
So we did 1-33 on our first pass through, and I'm not going to read them all off. I'll probably read off all 100 in the final episode, but I want you to go and check that out if you haven't heard it, and it included such debates as Peyton Manning or Clyde Frazier, Thurman Munson or Earl Monroe. We did number 11 was a three-way conversation between Mark Messier, Phil Simms, and Carl Hubbell. And we had sort of in the first third, we had a lot of legends, everybody from Willie Mays to Frank Gifford, Joe Namath, Babe Ruth, Mark Messier, really, you know, kind of a lot of really all-time greats in the history of New York sports. And 34-67, which is what we're doing tonight, is going to be a little bit different, I would say.
Yeah, and the nature of some of these sports, you know, I think when we had first recorded, I had written out up to about 50 or 55, and we stopped at 33. So to record to prepare for this episode, I had to do like 55-67, and I actually ended up going into like 80. But I pulled up a bunch of the teams like on a, you know, on a website tab for each one. And I kind of looked real quick through the basketball and I was like, all right, I can take both of these down, you know, at like 50 or five or whatever. Cause I was like, there's really nobody left worth talking about for basketball in either of these. And for baseball, it gets a little fuzzy when you get north of those numbers too. Although if any team would have some, it would be the Yankees, just because the last 20 years they've had so many numbers retired that you have had more guys in the 60s and 70s and 50s. You know, you start to get really into the purview of football linemen and linebackers, and then hockey, maybe not so much in the 70s and 80s, but certainly once you get back into the 90s. And, you know, so it just the sports kind of shift as you go along.
And maybe we should just explain real quick what the field of play is here. It is the professional sports teams in the New York metropolitan area. So that means Yankees, Mets, all three hockey teams, Rangers, Devils, and Islanders. It includes the Knicks and the Nets and the Giants and the Jets. Andrew and I both grew up in the Dutchess County, New York area. And so the way I like to look at it is any team that we would get on TV growing up fits into this category. And then, of course, also obviously the Brooklyn Dodgers and New York baseball Giants of olden days.
Yep. And that's, I was going to say that. And you get to, Uniform numbers didn't really become a thing at all until the late 20s. Most teams adopted them sometimes during the 30s in baseball. So you're not dealing with a ton of time for the Dodgers and Giants. Now, for the Dodgers specifically, that was the height of their franchise, certainly of the time they were in New York. So there's more there, but a few of the Giant players, like Christy Mathewson, did not wear a number. John McGraw did not have a number. So some of the Giants teams from the early 1900s and then the 20s get a little unrepresented here because they just what we're doing is numbers and they didn't wear numbers. So
And then the only other thing I would mention is that no college, and some of the lists you'll see will mention St. John's, especially they'll have Chris Mullin as I believe it was number 20 for St. John's. We didn't do that. First of all, it's just not really our area of expertise. And then second of all, it becomes a question of, especially for, what do you include? Do you include Seton Hall? Do you include Army, St. John's, Rutgers? It becomes sort of a slippery and somewhat unmanageable slope. So
And then
we stuck
also,
with the pros.
are you just talking about baseball or basketball and football then? Are you talking about, lacrosse? Like it becomes a thing. So just the pro sports teams that played in the New York metropolitan area, not just the New York Metropolitans, but in the area.
So what we've been doing is we've been going back and forth, and Andrew will give one, and then I'll say whether I agree or not, and then we'll come to a consensus on our list. So we are up to number 34, and why don't we dig right in?
So is it my turn for 34?
Yeah, why don't you kick us off?
All right, because I was probably doing the even numbers anyway. So for 34, I had Charles Oakley.
I did too. Oakley, who starred with the Knicks, was traded after the 87-88 season. He was traded for the Bulls, traded from the Bulls, where he had been Michael Jordan's close friend and on-court enforcer. He was traded for Bill Cartwright from the Bulls to the Knicks, and then, fittingly enough, or ironically enough, however you want to put it, ended up going and being a great rival to the Chicago Bulls throughout the most of the 1990s. He was traded before the 99 season to Toronto for Marcus Camby, but for most of the 80s, for the last year of Rick Pitino and through the Stu Jackson years and all the Riley years and the beginning of the Van Gundy years, all the first trip to the NBA Finals, all those wars against the Bulls, later the Pacers. The beginning of the Heat rivalry in the mid 90s. Oakley was kind of, in a lot of ways, the number two to Patrick Ewing, and so yeah, I went with him as well.
There's an extent to which the supporting cast of those 90s Knicks teams has been so lionized that they're really overrated. Everybody, has their favorite player from those teams. And, if you grew up in New York and you're not 60, at least, you don't remember a championship Knicks team. And those were the best Knicks teams since the set early 70s team broke up. And Ewing, as great a player as Ewing was, a lot of people gravitated towards the role players on those teams. Ironically, the reason the Knicks probably didn't win a championship is that those role players really were not enough support to Ewing, but that's for
There
another
was no
day.
second superstar,
Yeah.
yeah.
But Oakley was the second best player on those teams. And Oakley was an excellent player for a number of years for the Knicks. He was more than just toughness. I mean, he was a great rebounder. He was toughness, but he was also, he was the co-captain of the team. He was in a lot of ways the what you'd consider like the traditional captain. Ewing was the co-captain because he was the best player and he was a superstar. But Ewing was a little bit of an aloof guy, whereas Oakley was sort of the more traditional, what you think of as a captain for like hockey. That's kind of what Oakley was.
And he always reminds me of my honeymoon because in the spring of 2017, or actually not even the spring of 2017, February of 2017, I was sitting on a beach in Kauai, in Hawaii, and we 5 hours ahead. So it was like, it was an after I think it was actually an afternoon game that the Knicks were playing. And I was, but it was like, whatever time it was in the afternoon, sitting on the beach with my new wife, and all of a sudden I saw something happen, and I remember texting Andrew, and it was like, "Are you watching the Knick game? Apparently, Oakley just got ejected from the stands." And then 2 minutes later, holy F, I think he went after Dolan, which I don't know whether that's actually what happened or just sort of a version of what happened. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they've made peace or not. I honestly don't know the answer to that. But
I don't believe so.
The only other guy that was even on there that was considered was John Van Beesbrouck, who was a Rangers goalie in the 80s. But Rangers were, I guess, a decent enough team in the 80s, but not, not a championship level team the way the Knicks were in the 90s. So it was kind of a no-brainer with Charles Oakley for me.
All right. Number 35.
And just before we move on, I would say that I don't know about you, but I think we might be saying goodbye to the sport of basketball right now. I don't got a lot of other basketball coming, maybe even for the next episode either.
I think you're probably right. I don't see anything on here. And as I'm getting further up this list, I really don't think I will. So, yeah, you're probably right.
So we had Ewing, we had Frazier, we had Willis Reed, we had Dr. J, we had Bill Melchione from the old ABA Nets. And I might be missing one or two, but yeah, probably not a lot of basketball next. And on the topic of Rangers goalies, I went with Mike Richter, the Rangers goalie from sort of the time period, not that we were huge fans, but the time period that we were, growing up, the goalie on the Stanley Cup championship team in 94. I went with Mike Richter, the goalie of the Rangers, who played his whole career with the Rangers, actually from 89 all the way until 2003.
Yeah. And he was the starting goalie for, most of those years, certainly from the early 90s on, all-star 4 or 5 times. Wasn't one of the best two goalies in the league, and most of that time wasn't even the best goalie in the New York metropolitan area because of Martin Brodeur, but was still a perennial, really, really solid, bordering on great goalie, and was the goalie that brought the Rangers their first Stanley Cup in 54 years, and as of now, only Stanley Cup in 85 years at this point. So Brodeur nowhere really did you even see anybody, or not Brodeur, excuse me, Richter, and nowhere else really did you even see a also in the running thing. I think it's pretty clearly him.
Yeah, the only other one I came up with was Mike Mussina, but he only played the second half of his career with the Yankees, never won a championship, and I actually think that Mussina, in his whole time with the Yankees, despite the fact that he was a big name free agent, I don't think he actually ever made an all-star team as a Yankee. No, he didn't make an all-star team in his 8 years with the Yankees. He actually, a couple interesting things, the guy never won 20 games in his whole career, Mike Mussina, but finally won 20 in 2008, right before he retired. And Mike Mussina kind of signifies the years between the championships, because in 2001 he joined the team, they lost to Arizona, and then the year he retired, 2009, they went on and win the championship. So Mike Richter, he's got a championship, and he's also got a spot on this list. And we move on to, no, I'm sorry, go ahead.
To 36?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I thought you were about to say something else. Yeah, let's move on to 36.
So I went with Don Newcomb. You may bring somebody else up here, but Newcomb was a Brooklyn Dodger from 49 to 57 when they left. So we obviously won't count his last year with the Dodgers in 58. He did miss 2 years with the Korean War. So if you wanted to say 49, 50, 51, the knock would be he only wore the jersey for 7 seasons. In those 7 seasons, though, he was an all-star 6 times or 5 times. He won a Rookie of the Year. In 1956, he won the Cy Young and the MVP.
Let me just note there that in 56, that was when they still only had, that was actually the first year of the Cy Young Award. And it was the only, or no, maybe it wasn't. 55 might have been the first year. I think it was 56. I think 56 was the first year. Let me just verify. Yeah, 56 was the first year of the Cy Young, and it was only one award for the whole league. So anyway, continue.
Yeah, so won 27 games that year, 27-7, went 20-5 in 1955, 20 games in 1951, 19 in 1950, was on, if you look at 49 to 56, wasn't on the 47 team, but other than that, was on pretty much all of the Boys of Summer team outside of what he missed for military service, which I get it wasn't there on those teams, but there's a I am gonna lessen the ding on him for that. So I went with him just because I felt like more big moments, more, associated with being the lead pitcher on those teams. I have a feeling I know where you're going to go with it, but that's I went with Newcomb.
Yeah, I was really back and forth on this, and I think we've mentioned that the two lists that we pulled on, one was from the New York Post, and one was from The Athletic, and one of them went with Newcomb, and one of them went with Jerry Kuzman, the second great starter on the Miracle Mets team. Kuzman pitched a lot longer for the Mets than Newcomb did with the Dodgers. They both sort of started at around the same age, Newcomb at 23 and Kuzman with 24 with the Mets. I don't know. I'm really struggling with this. I guess maybe the reason I leaned Kuzman was because Kuzman is the second most important player on those 69 Met teams, whereas Newcomb is behind a lot of position players as far as importance on those Dodgers teams. Hodges, Snyder, Jackie Robinson, Campanella, so Pee-wee Reese. So, but I was really, this was one that I probably was in this episode, this might be the one I'm the most torn by. So, you call it. Where do we want to go here?
Well, I mean, I wrote Newcomb down, so if I'm calling it, I don't want to change my opinion. So I guess we'll go with Newcomb.
Yeah, this one was close. This was a tough one. It's funny too because this was in a lot of ways easier because and hold on, I just got to write Don Newcomb down here. This one was easier in a lot of ways because you're comparing two pitchers from kind of sort of the same era. Newcomb was more 60s and 70s, or I'm sorry, Kuzman was more 60s and 70s, whereas Newcomb was more 40s and 50s. But it's not as difficult as comparing Carl Hubbell to Phil Simms and Mark Messier. So there was a little bit easier there. So all right, we can go with Don Newcomb. I never pushed back too hard on a Brooklyn Dodger.
All right, so 37 is you.
So we talked a little bit last time about whether we would include baseball managers or not, and you hadn't originally, and I did. And this one, I went with Casey Stengel as number 37. He led the Yankees. He managed the Yankees from 1949 to 1960. He won seven World Series, and how many did they lose? They lost 55, 57, and 60. So seven World Series, 10 pennants. No other Yankee manager won as many pennants as Casey Stengel did. He then went on to manage the Mets. He's the only person whose jersey is retired by both the Mets and the Yankees. I don't know if this counts, but at some point in his career as either a player or manager, he wore the uniform of all four New York teams when they were in New York because he played for John McGraw in the Polo Grounds for the New York Giants. And then he played for the Brooklyn Dodgers and then also went on to manage the Brooklyn Dodgers for a couple years in the believe the late 30s. So I went with Casey Stengel. Both the lists that I saw also had Casey Stengel. So I don't know. I don't know if I'd be curious, just out of curiosity, where you went with if you were looking at a player. But I think that if managers count, you can't get a sort of a better New York 37 than Casey Stengel.
Yeah, and just this number alone is an argument for why we should have done managers. And
Yeah.
I believe we went with Joe Torre as
We
number
did.
six.
We
So
did,
we
yeah.
already did. I ended up with Pavel Zacha, who played for about 7 years with the Devils. That's the other thing too, is this wasn't easy. This was the one I spent the longest on because I didn't think we were going to do managers because nowhere else had anybody I could go off of because they all had Stengel. So yeah, no, if we're using managers, it's clearly Stengel, and that's, enough said.
All right. Number 38.
This one was interesting, and I wasn't in love with any of the lists. So I actually went with Bob Tucker from the Giants as number 38. I'm pulling up his numbers now. He was on a lot of the poorer eras of the Giants in the 70s, but some pretty good numbers. He was one of the few guys who actually panned out for them in that era. Never a 1,000-yard rusher, but actually didn't.
Well,
No,
he was a tight end, so he better not have been
okay, excuse me.
a
Never, never,
1,000-yard
never a
rusher.
thousand, never a 1,000-yard receiver. Excuse me. But I, again, this is one where the one list had what Rick Aguilera, and the other one I saw had Skip Lockwood. I think this one's probably open for interpretation. So, what did you have?
I had Rick Aguilera. Yeah, I saw the Skip Lockwood thing. The one thing I would say about Skip Lockwood that I like about him is that he actually he wrote his own autobiography, whereas most of these
Okay.
guys just have a ghostwriter and that they speak to once for an hour and then the guy just writes whatever he wants. So not a reason to put him on the team, but I Skip Lockwood or whatever, fine. I mean, he wasn't a starting pitcher for the Mets. He was on the team from 76 to 79, so only 4 years on a team that did nothing in those years. Those are sort of some of the really dark years of the Mets in the late 70s. So it's not Skip Lockwood. I had Rick Aguilera, who came to the team as a rookie in 85 and was there through 89. He was traded midseason in 89. Was a starter. I guess he probably would have been the fifth starter on the 86 Mets, and in the playoffs that year, he got into four games as a relief pitcher out of the bullpen. Was he the winning pitcher in either game six or game seven? He might have been. Hold on. Give me a second on that, because I given how thin we are here, I actually think that matters. Yeah, he was the winning pitcher in the Buckner game in game six. So I don't know. I guess I would kind of slightly push for Aguilera over Bob Tucker. Just because, I mean, Tucker, he put up some solid numbers. It looks like he was second team all pro 1 year, but he was a bright spot on some bad teams, Bob Tucker. But it's not like he was a really bright spot. He wasn't an Odell Beckham, putting up 1,000, 1,500 yard seasons while the team was bad. He really kind of, somebody had to catch those balls, maybe. So I think I might slightly push for Aguilera on this one.
Yeah, and that makes sense.
All right. So we'll go with Rick Aguilera. We don't have any football yet for this round, but I think we'll get to it soon. Although not with number 39, because for me, number 39 was, Roy Campanella, catcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers, one of the all-time greats in baseball history, one of my favorite historical baseball players who won three MVPs in 5 years with the Brooklyn Dodgers. He won it in 51, 53, and in their World Series year of 55, and I just want to pull up his stats here, so bear with me. A guy who actually started playing organized baseball at 15 in the Negro Leagues, didn't get to the Dodgers until 1948 when he was 26 years of age, but nonetheless had some really, really good years with the Dodgers. Like I said, three MVPs in 5 years, and if you think about who he's going against in those years, you're talking about guys like Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, Stan Musial, Duke Snider, early years of Ernie Banks, really just, one of the all-time great catchers who, had it not been for segregation and also the tragic automobile accident that cut his career short, or not too short, maybe, because he was already 35, but probably would have played a couple more years.
He probably would have been on that 59 team.
He probably would have been at least around on the team that won in LA. I think that's a really good way to put it. Yeah. So I didn't see anybody else even mentioned. I don't know. This feels like a no-brainer.
Yeah, he was an all-star basically every year he was in the league. They were in the World Series basically every year he was in the league. He was one of three MVPs. He also, you know, what was he, like the third or fourth player to cross the color barrier? Like he was on the team in 48, so it wasn't. He was definitely in that, you know.
He was in the first five or six, without question.
Yeah, so no, it's Campanella. It's not close. I don't even know who is second, but whoever it is not close to Campanella.
Yeah, nobody else came to mind. I can't even think on any of the teams. I guess Larry Zonka probably wore 39 with the Giants in the late 70s for a year or two, but
regardless.
All right, I think we're on to 40.
We are into it. We are into the 40s.
And it's your turn. Me. Yeah,
that's right. Sorry. So this one, and I have to admit that this one made me kind of, not the number, but it made me reconsider a thing I've said for years, or not reconsider it, but reconsider the guy I've said it about. I went with Joe Morrison. Joe Morrison is, not to be confused with Joe Morris, who was on the Giants in the 80s. Joe Morrison was on the Giants from 1959 to 1972. So was on, you know, came in at the, first of all, I don't think I realized he was on those late 50s, early 60s teams.
Yeah.
I think in my head, he like came in after that or previous to looking this up. He was there longer than I thought he was in terms of years, in terms of earlier, and he was much more productive than I thought he was. Because he used to be the one I would always use the example of, like, you know, the Giants retired too many numbers. We really need to have Joe Morrison's number retired. And while certainly he's not, you know, wouldn't be in the upper half of Giants who have their jerseys retired, there's several more guys who deserve to have their jerseys retired less than Joe Morrison.
Yeah, he really wasn't a key member of the team until if you look at the NFL championship games, he was on the team in 59, 61, 62, 63. So basically four of their six title games they appeared in that time frame, he was on them. But he didn't get any carries until the 63 championship game, when he got 18 carries. So they weren't really depending on him until that 63 season. But yeah, I mean, maybe should his number be retired, maybe not, but sort of like you, I had kind of always associated with him with sort of like a Homer Jones sort of type of thing, late 60s. But
yeah, I thought he was on the team from 65 to 72 and was hurt twice, and yeah, you know what I mean, it was a longer, more impressive career than I remember.
Yeah, they called him
old. New.
They called him old, dependable, and yeah, he was on the team for parts of three decades, and you know, was a service. Never any sort of a Pro Bowler or anything like that. I'd be curious to go back and look, and this is not the episode for it because we got so much to cover, as to why exactly it was the Giants saw fit to retire his number. I don't know much about the guy, but yeah, I mean, you know, the only other 40 I could think of was Kurt Thomas. So yeah, I would definitely go with Joe Morrison.
So the only thing I can think of with that is if it was retired right after he played, it's very possible they were just looking for somebody to have their jersey retired. Something along those lines. And like you said, you're right, it's not the time to look for it. I Googled it. It didn't come up real quick. Or is it possible he had his jersey retired in 1976 when Giant Stadium opened and it was like, oh, it's Joe Morrison Day. But we'll look into that some other time.
All right. I think we're on to number 41. This felt like a no-brainer. Tom Seaver, one of the greatest pitchers of all time. Definitely the best player in Mets history. Probably the only Met that you could really consider to be sort of an upper echelon all-time great, leader of the 69 Mets, you know, also led them to the 73 World Series, put up some crazy numbers, including at least one. No, I guess he actually never won the pitching triple crown, but he led the league in wins twice, in ERA three times, in strikeouts it looks like five times, three Cy Young awards, Rookie of the Year in 67, first ballot Hall of Famer. In fact, I think until Jeter and Rivera got, you know, what was it? Was it Jeter missed one vote and Rivera was unanimous, or maybe it was the other way around. Prior to that, Tom Seaver was the highest vote getter in baseball Hall of Fame history. Met fans sometimes try and equate some of their all-time greats with Yankee all-time greats, and it comes across as a little bit forced, but Tom Seaver is as good a pitcher as any other pitcher, I would say, who ever set foot in New York, except maybe for Christy Mathewson. So
yeah, and interestingly enough, with that, I thought was Tom Seaver's very famous for his drop and drive motion, mm-hmm. where his knee would actually be dirty at the end of a game from hitting the mound constantly. Years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago now, an old picture surfaced of, it might have been the 1912 World Series, maybe 1911, whatever. The Giants in a World Series from back then, and it's a still picture, but you can clearly see that Christy Mathewson is dropping and driving or yeah, it's Seaver. I mean, he's the face of the franchise. He three-time Cy Young Award winner, like you said. He's there are fans, you know, there are 20-year-old fans now who are pissed off about the Mets trading Tom Seaver in 1977.
Yeah.
And, you know, 25 years before they were born. That's, you know, that's how much he means to that franchise. So Seaver in a walk.
All right. You're up next, and yeah, this is 42 is really, really interesting to me. And as I was, well, I don't want to steal your thunder. You go ahead, and then I'll give my thoughts.
I went with Mariano Rivera over Jackie Robinson. The task before me is the greatest player to ever wear the number 42 in New York. Mariano Rivera is the greatest relief pitcher of all time. He is, you know, like you said, he was a unanimous Hall of Famer. He was a key part, in some ways, the key part of five world championship teams.
Probably symbolizes the era more than anybody else.
Yes. Jackie Robinson is a more important history and a more important figure in American history. Absolutely. And I have talked frequently in the past about how I think Jackie Robinson is underrated as a baseball player because the people who are interested in telling the story are interested in telling the story of, he got booed, you know, he came out on April 15th and in Cincinnati, Pee Wee Reese put his arm around him and the Philadelphia manager was a jerk to him, and then the rest is history. And I've always said that it's unfortunate because I feel like Jackie Robinson's story is much more interesting and complex than that. The only other thing I will say, and I think it is a great thing that they did this, and I think the modern thing they did it yesterday. Today's April 16th as we're recording this. The way they honor him is also very good. And retiring the jersey in 1997 was, I think, a very nice touch. It was very creative and a very fitting way to honor him. Jackie Robinson, as being singularly synonymous with the number 42 above all else, is a modern invention, starting in the mid-90s when they retired his number throughout baseball.
Yeah.
You know, no, in 1990, if somebody had said number 42, nobody would have automatically leapt to Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. The movie would not have been called 42 if it came out in 1993.
Yes. So that's my point. If we're stripping everything else, Mariano Rivera was a better baseball player than Jackie Robinson. So I went with Mariano Rivera.
In New York, and, you know, Robinson also suffered not only from segregation.
Wait, was I supposed to count his Monarchs tenure?
No, I'm just saying that it's also worth noting, and, you know, Jack Robinson got, and I just mentioned it this with Campanella, but like Robinson didn't even start playing in the Negro Leagues because he was 26, till he was 26 because of the war, and then he was, you know, not didn't come up to the to Brooklyn until he was 28. So who knows if Robinson, if things had been different as far as what age he would have gotten to play. You know, Jackie Robinson led the league in war three times with crazy war numbers, 9.3, 9.6, 8.4. The other thing, I know I've mentioned this before, is that he was incredibly versatile. He played first, third, second, and the outfield all for like full seasons at some point for the Dodgers. So yeah, it's hard to pass him up. And he was, in addition to being a trailblazer and a civil rights icon, he was a great, great player, but there's one of those things where it's like, you know, sort of like we said, I think with, I forget what the number was, where it was like, yeah, he would have beaten everybody else on this list, but not this one. Rivera, who was inspired to wear 42 by Jackie Robinson, probably eclipses him a little bit when it comes to actual on the field New York contributions.
Yes, that's where I landed with it.
All right, now maybe a little bit of a step down as we yeah. go to number 43, and I am up, and I went with R.A. Dickey, one of the knuckleball pitcher who joined the Mets late in his career, won a Cy Young Award. This was another one that was a little bit slim. I don't know if you didn't go with Dickey, I think I have an idea of where you might have gone, but I went with R.A. Dickey.
I went with Jeff Nelson. Did you think I was going to go with Spider Lockhart?
I thought you were going Spider Lockhart. Yeah.
And Lockhart was a Giant safety. To be honest, Spider Lockhart obviously was a generation before me. The thing that Spider Lockhart is most famous for now is that he died in 1986, and there was a spider patch on the 86 Giants jerseys all year when they won the Super Bowl.
Yeah,
in honor.
And on the patch, it was like an actual spider. It was like a picture, a drawing of a spider with a 43.
But a really good player in his own right, and for a long time. If Dickey winning the Cy Young is the be-all and end-all, then yes, I would put him over Nelson. Dickey was only on the team for 3 years. Now, Jeff Nelson was on the Yankees for 5 years and then came back in 03 for a little while. The 5 years he was on the team, though, all were championship teams. Those three straight teams in 98, 99, 2000, he was the primary setup man for Mariano Rivera, as we spoke, as we're talking about now. If you're going to look and go, well, he's, you know, was he, you know, I don't think he ever made an all-star team, or if he did, it probably wasn't with the Yankees. You have to be a little objective about middle relievers making all-star teams, mm-hmm. especially when you factor in that that's the spot they would put, you know, back. We'll use that era, but it's like, we need to put somebody from Tampa Bay on the team.
Sure.
We need to, like, a middle. So, you know, back then when the All-Star team was, you know, whatever, 30 guys, if you had 12 or 13 pitchers, you were going to, it was tough to make the All-Star team as a middle reliever, especially as a Yankee middle reliever, when there was going to be six Yankees on the team already.
Well, yeah, they would look at the, you know, the Blue Jays or whoever else was crappy in those mid-90s, mid-late 90s, and be like, okay, we got a reliever here with a 2.4 ERA. Let's put him in.
More often than not, especially given that era, it was like, we got a reliever here with a 4.4 ERA. let's put him in.
Yeah, I think I would push for Dickey because he did win a Cy Young, and so yeah, I mean, like you said, it's kind of but I'd probably push for Dickey a little bit here.
All right, well, we can go with Dickey. That's fine.
All right,
you're right, though. Quite the step down from 42.
All right, so we're on now to number 44, and it's your turn. So this was another one that seemed pretty easy to me, but you go ahead.
Yeah, it's Reggie Jackson. You know, Reggie Jackson's Yankee career is one of those that you can debate sort of the stature of it, because he was only there for 5 years, and yeah, what, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81. He was there for 5 years, you know, and being such a self-promoter, I think he managed to talk himself into sort of the discussion of all-time Yankee greats, whether he, you know, probably doesn't deserve that higher praise, but he certainly is the best number 44. I mean, multiple time champion. He was the biggest star on those teams. And, you know, it's one of those that's, again, it's become talked about so much, but like the guy's performance in that 77 World Series is the stuff of legend. If that was another franchise and that was their only championship, that would actually be almost a bigger deal. Like, I know New York and the whole, I didn't come to New York to be a star. I brought my star with me and, you know, everything. But like, I almost wonder if that feat gets diminished by the fact that it was just another Yankee feat instead of if that was the only World Series the White Sox won, how big a deal it would be, you know?
No, yeah, I mean, think about moments that get talked about in, you know, Kansas City or Baltimore, you know, teams that have won, or Philly, you know, teams that have won one World Series or two World Series in the last half century. So, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely, Reggie Jackson. And then for number 45, I went back to NFL, back to the Giants, back to the 1950s, and I went with first black Giant, first black player inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, defensive back Emlyn Tennell.
Yeah, I went with Tennell as well. Tennell is another one of those guys who, and it's like even the post here, Tug McGraw instead of Emlyn Tennell. It's another one that sort of suffers from the idea that there was no football played before the first Super Bowl, that was sort of the invention of the NFL. And instead, he was, like you said, he was a trailblazer in his own right. And also just, you know, one of the best players on those Giant teams, came up in 48 and was on the Giants all the way through 58. So he was on, you know, what, 11 years, first team all pro four times, Pro Bowler pretty much every year of the 50s. You know, one of the best Giants of that era. Obviously wasn't on the teams in 61 and 62 and 63, but actually was on the Packers in those years. But yeah, no, clearly Emlyn Tennell.
Yeah, think about this. The guy played in, again, actually, it's looking like he didn't play in 59. I don't know, maybe he was hurt or something, but he played in the 58 championship, then went to Green Bay, played in the 60. Oh, of course he didn't play in the 59 championship. He wasn't on a team anymore. He was in Green Bay, so there's my reason. But yeah, his
So he was
last
already in Green Bay. Oh no, 59 was when, never mind.
Lombardi
That
went,
was
yeah.
when Lombardi got there, yeah.
His last game with the Giants was the Colts 58 greatest game ever played. So, yeah, Lombardi, that was the one guy, and I'm sure he would have brought more if he could, but that was the one guy Lombardi brought with him to Green Bay when he took the job in 59 was Emlyn Tennell. So, yeah, definitely with you, or you're with me on Emlyn Tennell. And now we're on to number 46.
And this is another one that I think is relatively straightforward. I went with Andy Pettit. Again, Andy Pettit, another one who, you know, maybe is more highly regarded in the minds of Yankee fans than of baseball, you know, sort of collectively in that era. And I'm not even talking about the positive drug test or anything like that, but, you know, was the best pitcher on the balance of all of those late 90s, early 2000 teams. Not to immediately go to, probably should have won the Cy Young in 1996. They gave it to Pat Henkin, I believe. Was always Torrey's, kind of became Torrey's game three starter. Because Torrey always had this theory that game three was the biggest game, because you could either take a dominant 3-0 lead, you could break a tie, or you could keep yourself alive. Like there, and more often than not for the Yankees of that era, game three was on the road. So he was pitching the first road game of a lot of those series as well. And also came back. That's the other thing you got to remember too. Came back, was gone for a while in Houston, and we can't count that for this. Pitched well in Houston, came back to the Yankees in was 08 his first year back with the Yankees, or was it? No, it wasn't 09. Was it
No, it was
07?
07. 07.
07.
He
So he was
signed
only
a
got
3-year contract with Houston after the 03 season.
Yeah, so he was gone for 3 years, came back 07, was there 07, 08, 09, I think retired for a year, then came back again for a couple of years.
That's right, yeah.
He was definitely gone a year. And perhaps the and again, I don't not looking to sort of go over this again, but One of the most ringing endorsements you can say about Andy Pettitte was how much the Yankees missed Andy Pettitte. We've talked about this before. There is no way if Andy Pettitte was on that team in 2004, that would have happened.
No, they
it
probably would have.
Just,
he would have been a stopper
have.
In one of those games, probably.
Because he would have pitched one of those games, and it just wouldn't have happened. So anyway, we can certainly. Well, I was going to say we could talk about that in another episode, but we're never going to.
Imagine him going toe to toe with. Although I guess it's not entirely fair. I was going to say, imagine him going toe to toe with Schilling in the Bloody Sock game, but that was not. I don't even remember who pitched for the Yankees in that game, but it was whoever it was pitched well. Schilling just pitched better. But yeah, no, I think your point is a good one. And he pitched that, which I still say is the best game, you know, as far as both teams are concerned. The best game I ever saw pitched was him against Smoltz in game 5 of the World Series in 96. Had a couple really brutal starts in his time, whether that was Game 6 against Arizona in the 0-1 World Series when the Yankees had a chance to clinch, or game 1 against Atlanta. But then he also had some really, really good games as a Yankee starting pitcher in the postseason. So, yeah, number 46 is definitely Andy Pettitte.
Yeah, and the one last thing with that game you mentioned, too. Think about that. And what was that, his second year in 96?
Correct.
In his second year, he had gotten lit up in game 1 at home. And what, 6 days later, whatever it is, he's pitching on the road in game 5 of the World Series
against John Smoltz.
Yeah. And they give him one run and he makes it hold up. So
yeah.
Phenomenal.
Number 47, I went sticking in the baseball realm. I went with Jesse Orosco, Met closer, or Met relief pitcher from 79 to 87, was on the mound for both the 86 NLCS clinching out as well as the World Series clinching out. Some folks mentioned Tom Glavine, and Tom Glavine obviously is an all-time great, but if you're talking about importance to the New York team, in this case, we're talking about the Mets one way or the other. To me, it's a no-brainer that it's Jesse Orosco.
Now, do you factor in his Yankee tenure?
God, that was so weird that year because it was the Yankees traded for him and Armando Benitez right around the same time. It was like a Met closer reunion. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, they were both gone. And I'll never forget.
I mean, to be fair, Jesse Orosco was 46 years old.
No, but they traded him to somebody else. Somebody else took him. I think the Twins, maybe.
The Twins, yeah.
I'll never forget when they traded him because I don't know. I must have been. I was living in college. I was up in Boston that summer without cable, so I don't remember how I even saw this. But I remember SportsCenter did an icon that basically there was basically like only like you only had to go back like 3 common teammates to get to Babe Ruth or Jesse Orosco. Yeah.
So, you know, all joking aside, he was the closer on the 86 team. He was, you know, been on the team like you said since he didn't pitch in 80, but he was there 79. You know, up through 87, he was there. And then I didn't realize he was on the Dodgers in 88. For some reason, I just never registered with me. Mm-hmm. Really good for them, you know, 84, 31 saves, 85, 17, 86, 21. And there's really no main other. Sorry, Tom Glavine is not gonna beat him out for that spot.
Agreed. All right. 48.
So 48 is Jacob DeGrom.
Yeah.
Jacob DeGrom from the Mets, and we're really like pitching heavy right now.
Yeah, we definitely are.
And you can tell some of these articles were written when Jacob DeGrom was doing his dominant years in the Mets, because some of them are like, you know, basically saying like hard to imagine anybody will ever surpass Jacob DeGrom. And it's like, certainly, he had some tremendous years, but it's not like inconceivable somebody would ever be better than him. But rookie of the year, he was with the Mets from 2014 through 2021. Rookie of the year in 14, Cy Young in 18 and 19. And then in 2020, which, yeah, was an abbreviated season, but finished in third in the Cy Young, had 5 straight and 6 out of 7 years where he finished in the top 10 in Cy Young voting, was on that team in 2015 that got to the World Series, you know, the three-headed monster of him and Syndergaard and Matt Harvey. Best year 2018, rated a 1.70 ERA. and had a few years in there where, I mean, 2018, 1.70 ERA, 10-9, because they just did not score for him. The next year, 2.43 ERA, 11-8. They just did not give him any run support,
Yeah,
but.
and in some of those games he probably didn't go that. I'd be curious to know sort of if you were to shorten the win criteria to less than 5 innings, how many he would have, because I wonder if in some of those games also he didn't go the full 5 innings. But that now that you mentioned it though, I feel like that was kind of the narrative around here is that they never scored for him, right?
Yeah, well, and there was a couple of years where it was like almost a joke how little, like how he would pitch 7 innings, he'd leave with a 1-0 lead, and then they'd lose 3-1 or something like that. Like those late teens teams when the Mets started to go downhill in quality, it became like an ongoing like thing you couldn't believe that it would happen to him every game.
I'd like to
I
see
think there
that
was like
as.
a period where they went like 4 straight starts where he didn't get a run of support or something like
That
that.
sounds vaguely familiar. I'd be curious if Baseball Reference could come up with a stat of, like, saves blown for a guy. Like, how many times did the guy leave with the lead and then they didn't preserve it for him? A couple of the things I would just mention about DeGrom. First of all, he was the guy who actually ended up panning out when it was, Harvey and Syndergaard and DeGrom, the team that went to the World Series in 2015. DeGrom was the one who actually stayed with the team and was really, really good for a while. Won the or no, he, what year did Texas win the World Series? Was he on that team or was that the no, yeah, 23, right? Oh, but he
Yeah.
barely pitched. That's he was hurt. That was what it was. Yeah, he barely pitched that year for them. He only got into 6 games for them, and then they shut him down for the year. Because there was talk that year with Texas where he was going to come back for the postseason, and then it just never happened. The only other thing I would mention about him is for a period of 4 years, he basically never missed a start. 31, 32, 32, and then 12 in the COVID year, which was 1 every 5 games because they played 60 games that year. So injuries later on, sort of in the latter part of his career, but incredibly durable for a while also was Jacob deGrom.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's not a number where you see a lot of, great players. There's not a lot of football players in the high 40s, and we've talked about how basketball is pretty much over by now, so he also probably benefits from not having a ton of stiff competition.
So number 49, it's my turn, and it's a guy whose career was kind of in some ways similar to DeGrom, was who I went with, a guy who had some really, really phenomenal dominating years, but kind of falls just short of that Hall of Fame bar. And that's Ron Guidry, who started with the team in the late 70s and was there all the way until the late 80s. 78, the year of the incredible comeback against the Yankees or against for the Yankees against the Red Sox. He was 25-4. I think that was the year he set the single games had the what was it 18 strikeouts in a game that he had. I'd have to verify that, but number 49, I went Ron Guidry.
Yeah, and everybody always goes right to 1978, where he went 25-3 with a 1.74 ERA. But he was on the team from 75, so came up and he only pitched in 10 games that year. But he was on that was the last year of the Shea Stadium Yankees.
Yep.
Was there all the way till 88. So if you think about it, he was on those like 85, that team we always talked about is like a team nobody really thinks about that was out of nowhere good. He was 22-6
Yeah, that might have been
in.
his second great best year. Although I got to say, 83, which was one of the Billy Martin years, 21 complete games. That's impressive. He won 21 games and had 21 complete games. Even for the early 80s, that was really damn impressive. When you figure the year before that, so this is interesting. Let's just look at this real quick. 1980. Let's start with 1980. This is his complete games. 5-0-6, 21, and then back to 5-11, 5-2. So yeah, some really good years throughout. Again, probably not a Hall of Famer, but from a Yankee point of view, he's one of the all-time great Yankees of the quote-unquote modern era.
Like that 85 team, he was 34 years old. He finished second in the Cy Young to Brett Saberhagen. Won it in 78, third in 79. You know, I'm seeing half a dozen All-Stars here. And, you know, by those 80s teams, and certainly he was certainly in 78, he was the ace. And the other thing I want to say is, like, just think about how much garbage he had to put up with around him. Like, now, I don't mean the players on the team. I mean, I think about how much just chaos. He had to take the ball every 4 days. There were probably, how many different times do you think he made a start and by the next start there was a different manager? Like, think about that. Had to have happened to him at least five times. Like,
you just made me think of a story. You've obviously heard the Artie Lang story about when they went to meet Bob Uecker and everything. Yeah. There's a story about what Artie Lang tells another story, and then the bags on you story with Don Drysdale and Ken Boyer. I assume you've heard that one with the phony kidnapping. There's another story apparently where Bob Uecker was doing a Monday night baseball game, and Billy Martin called up to the booth and said, "Hey Bob, do you want to go out with me afterwards?" And so, like, they got in the limo, and then, like, Billy's like, "Oh, we got to pick up my girlfriend." And they go like two blocks to this apartment complex in the Bronx and pick up some teenager that was Billy Martin's girlfriend. So they go to some club in Manhattan. Some guy comes up to Billy Martin and said, "Why'd you put Dick Tidrow in the game so early?" Billy Martin cold cocked the guy. they both got arrested, and then Bob Uecker had to go and, like, bring the other girl home in the limo, and then Billy Martin didn't speak to him for 5 years because he thought Bob Uecker slept with his girlfriend. And at the end, I guess the end of the story is Bob's like, "I gave Billy a break. He was loaded. It was fine."
Interesting. So,
yes, chaos for the Yankees in the 70s and early 80s, and Ron Guidry made his way through it. And we are on to number 50.
So I put down Ken Strong.
Me too.
And as I'm looking here, I mean, was he on all of these giant teams? Like, there's some gaps here. We're like, was he not on the team in 36, 37, and 38? And then again, not in 41, 40, 41, 42, and 43?
Well, that one at least makes sense because of what do you call?
The war?
Because of the war, yeah.
Not in 1940, it doesn't. Unless you're saying,
or even 41 for that.
Unless you're saying he retired and came back. But long story short, he was on the team a total of 8 years, although spread over a 13-year period. He was on the 34 team that won the championship. Truthfully, not even trying to be funny as I look at this, but I mean, technically the team he played on before that was a New York team too. I don't know if he wore number 50, but he was on the Staten Island Stapletons,
which was an NFL team.
I mean, it does count.
Well, and you got to figure too, we've got guys on the team who played on teams that were located in Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, the Bronx, obviously, Jersey, a couple different places in Jersey. Yeah, to have a guy who played in Staten Island, we got to have that. Yeah, Ken Strong was a kicker, and he obviously played defense too. But he was also mostly known as a running back, a halfback, and a fullback. Like you said, and I think we can trust Wikipedia. Because with Wikipedia, the less controversial the subject, the more you can trust it, I think. And I don't think the career of Ken Strong in the 30s is all that controversial. After the 1935 championship game, which the Giants lost, Strong's best season with the best game with the Giants actually might have been the sneakers game, the 34 NFL title game, where he scored 2 fourth-quarter touchdowns as well as a field goal and 2 extra points. But after the 35 game, he signs with the New York Yankees in the second American Football League, which we talked about in our football rival leagues episode a few years ago. In He returned to the New York Yankees football team in 37, but then left after three games to go be an assistant coach with the NYU Violets football team. 38, he plays for the Giants farm team, which I didn't even know existed, the Jersey City Giants. Because he was barred from the NFL for jumping to the rival league. Finally returns to the Giants in 39, plays in 40, retires, and then in 1944 comes back and appears in all 10 games for the 44 Giants and helps lead them to the 44 NFL championship game. I would also note that he is a part of the war effort. He participates in a bowling exhibition with another honoree on the list, a guy named Babe Ruth. And I know this because I wrote about it in my article for the Sabre publication on Yankee Stadium that Andrew and the rest of my family came and watched me present on a couple months ago. So I know that for a fact. So, yeah, a very odd career that I kind of want to learn more about now, but I think he gets it for number 50.
And again, if 50 is not a number that gets used in a lot of sports. So,
yeah.
All right. 51, we're officially, well, I don't know if you factor in zeros or whatever, but we're basically halfway through.
And I think we're going to have fun with zero in the next episode, by the way. But
well, I was getting frustrated looking at it for this time, like zero, double zero, when I was finally like, I don't need it for this episode, I'll wait. But go ahead.
51's got to be Bernie Williams, four championships, numbers retired. I couldn't even think of anybody else. I'd have to look at these articles and see if anybody had an honorable mention, but if it's not Bernie Williams, who's better than Bernie, I guess I would say.
Yeah, and I don't see both of these just list Bernie and then move on. Yeah, Bernie, again, the best position player on those late 90s teams. I know Derek Jeter ended up having a better career, but at that time, Bernie was the best position player on those late 90s teams. You know, had been on the team since 91, and you look at that run from 96 to 02, he was an all-star pretty much every year. His best year was probably 98 when he won the batting title, finished seventh in MVP that year. But also remember that was 1998 when guys were hitting 70 home runs.
And that after that 98 season was when he almost left and the Yankees were going to sign Albert Bell. And then only because Albert Bell bailed on them at the last minute did they keep Bernie Williams. And then Bernie Williams hit 342 in 1999.
Yeah, it was like a foregone conclusion he was going to leave, but that was finally the year that Steinbrenner started to respect him enough to be there. And, you know, was on the team, was on the 03 team that went to the World Series. Obviously, he was on the 01 team that went to the World Series. You know, again, a guy who maybe doesn't get his due because he's the one who gets screwed the most by that dumb core four branding, where it makes it seem like those were the four best players on those late 90s teams.
Well, and I would, not to go on too much of a tangent here, but I would also note that for all intents and purposes, Jorge Posada wasn't even on the 96 team. So
yeah, that was a fine designation in 2009 to talk about the four guys on that team who had been on the late 90s teams, but it doesn't retroactively apply to the late 90s teams. So anyway,
Bernie's
that's for another day.
The other thing too is that a lot of guys, and we did a whole episode on this that I think lasted about 9 hours, a lot of guys contributed to that 96 team. In fact, probably all 25 guys contributed to that 96 team. Bernie Williams was the best player on that 96 team in the postseason. 345 average, 6 home runs, 15 RBIs. I'd imagine all of those were highs for the Yankees in 96. So the most memorable Yankee championship run of our lifetimes, Bernie Williams was the driving force offensively for that team.
And one last thing I'll say specifically about the number. There became a bit of a question when in 05, when he was going into his 15th year or whatever at 36 years old and they signed Randy Johnson, there was sort of a brief thing of, is Randy Johnson going to push him out of this number? You know, are they going to, is with all the big money they're giving him, is Bernie, and I don't believe Johnson even made an issue of it and just took, 41 or whatever he took. But I just remember that being for very briefly a thing of like, is this going to be a thing? And then it just wasn't. And then Then it was smooth sailing from then on with Randy Johnson as a Yankee.
Pushing
But
cameraman and every other damn thing.
yeah.
All right, I think we are on to 52, and is your choice.
So this is CC Sabathia, who will go into the, or I guess, yeah, he'll go into the Hall of Fame this summer. Yeah.
And he's going in as a Yankee.
Justifiably so. He, the article I hear from the, see from the one we've been quoting from the Post was like a redo of an article for 5 or 10 years before that. And the quote here in the article is, it was going to take a special talent to push Buck Williams off this list, but CC Sabathia did that. So CC Sabathia comes to the Yankees in 2009 at 28 years old. He is the immediately wins a championship with them as the ace, and was every bit the dominant player for them that you would have hoped. For the next 3 years, he was a top four finisher in the Cy Young. Through 2012, one of the best pitchers in baseball, one of the ERA leaders, one of the one of the Cy Young leaders. Faced some trouble after that. 2013, 2014, 2015, it almost looked like his career was coming to an end, where 2014 he only makes eight starts, and he's, it just looked like it might have been over. And then rebounds and has a really strong second act to his career. 2015 through 2019, he makes 27 through 30 starts every year except for 2019, has a real career renaissance. And yeah, those Yankee teams were underwhelming. And, he left. What was the, well, I guess 2017, they made the deep run to the, within a game of the World Series. And then 2019, by 2019, he was gone, because 2019 was the year where he was having sort of a, after a really bad start, he was pitching really well, like the second half of the year. And then I feel like that was when he left to take care of his alcohol problem. What
No,
was that?
that was before the postseason 1 year.
Okay. But it
Yeah,
wasn't
what?
his last year.
Oh, was that? No, I'm gonna look that up, but I think that was earlier.
So anyway, it's CC Sabathia. And really, for a guy who, he'd been with Cleveland, and then they traded him to Milwaukee for half a year in 08, which was probably the most dominant run of his career. He went 11 and 2 with a 1.65 ERA for Milwaukee. Hits free agency. Everybody knows he's going to get big money. The Yankees basically have to pile money in front of him to get him to not go to the West Coast, because he's a West Coast guy. He wanted to go back to the West Coast. As weird as it sounds with modern eyes, the A's were certainly after him, and then you had the California teams, the Southern California teams, and the Yankees just wouldn't stop upping everybody's offer until he signed with them, and really turned into a quintessential New York guy, to the point where I think he still lives at least a good amount of the year in New York. He's a fixture in a lot of, at Yankee games and, just around the city, and was the ace of them on a championship team. So certainly CC Sabathia.
A couple things about him. So first of all, the alcoholism thing was right before the 2015
Oh, it was a lot earlier than I thought. Okay,
season.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So he came back from that, and that was a team that just lost in the wild card round
A one game wild card to the
to the
Astros.
Astros. Yeah, that was the first Yankee loss to the Astros. He was a key player on one of my favorite recent Yankee teams, and I think it was probably just because they were so surprisingly good with all these new guys. But I have really a lot of fond memories of that 2017 Yankee team with Judge's first year, where they made this improbable run to being within a game of the World Series. So he was still around for that stuff with, Girardi as the manager, and well, I guess Girardi was the manager for his whole time, but like, the Judges and those types of guys. He also, in a game against Tampa Bay late in his career, one of the pitchers threw at Austin Romine, who was kind of Sabathia's personal catcher, and so then Sabathia hit the next batter and looked at the Rays dugout and said, "That's for you, bitch."
As he was getting ejected, I
And
think, yeah.
that was my fantasy baseball name for like 5 years. My logo was a picture of him pointing, and it was my team name was "That's for you, bitch." And then the other thing I'll remember, and this might have actually been the first time that I brought my now wife Allison to New York to meet my parents or to stay with us for the first time. And you were there, and we were watching the Yankee playoff game, and I just remember you Sabathia was pitching, and I just remember you just looked and you said, "It looks like he's wearing pajamas," because he had like the baggy uniform and everything. So I'm glad he's in the Hall of Fame. If you'd asked me during his career, I don't know if I would have considered him a first ballot Hall of Famer, but I'm glad he's going in. I'm glad he's going in as a Yankee. And it's funny to think that, you know, we have no New Jersey Nets on this. We have a couple of guys from the ABA days, and it would have been
Dr.
Buck.
J.
Yeah, from the
Oh, New
ABA guys.
Jersey Nets.
Yeah, we have no New Jersey Nets. We got Melchione, we got Dr. J. It's funny to think we would have had an 80s New Jersey Net on this team if it wasn't for Sabathia, but he's there, so we don't. All right, we're on to number 53, right?
We are on to number 53.
Well, I think there's going to be a little bit of a theme shift here. Maybe not for every guy, but we've entered a little bit of a new time period. We're about to get into some 80s Giants linebackers, and to me, this is Harry Carson.
Harry Carson, absolutely, Hall of Famer, the captain of the 86 Giants team. Really, him along with George Martin were the two guys who, and I think Martin maybe even a little more so, who spanned the era from the crappy, mid-70s. Now, Carson's rookie year was 76, so he didn't get the pleasure of playing at the Yale Bowl or at Shea Stadium, but was with the dark ages teams, but as early as 78 was a Pro Bowler, second team All Pro in 78, and then pretty much a perennial Pro Bowler through the end of his career in 88. Got to that first crunch bunch core of guys when they draft LT in 81, and it's him and LT and Brad Van Pelt and Brian Kelly, and then later on when it's him and Reasons and Taylor and Banks and Pepper Johnson, and just a key player in the not even a key player, one of the key players of that great defense, and a giant Hall of Famer and legend, I think you have to say, and the Gatorade dunk.
Possibly also, you know, something else that's worth mentioning is the fact that he was the only guy that Parcells sent out for the coin toss for Super Bowl 21. The Broncos sent out like eight different guys, and Parcells just sent out Harry Carson for that coin toss. We're on to 54 now, and I think it's your turn.
So I went with Goose
Yep,
Gossage for
gotta be the
this.
goose.
Again, you're getting into like linebacker territory, but none springs to mind as a from a Giant standpoint or a Jet standpoint. Goose Gossage, he was a bunch of different places, but why does this include his minor league stats? I just pulled up his baseball reference, and for some reason it came in as minor league stats. Had been with Chicago, had been with Pittsburgh, was only a Yankee from what, 78 to 83, and then briefly again in 89, but that doesn't really factor into it. But immediately became the main, reliever closer in a time when closer meant seventh inning on guy in 78, fifth in Cy Young in 78, part of that championship team, and then 80 and 81, he's top five in Cy Young again. He's an all-star every year he's with the Yankees, except for 1979. Save numbers 27, 18, 33, 20, 30, 22. And again, guy was on the team from 1978 to 83. How many different times was Billy Martin his manager?
Yeah, Hall of Famer. In 77, the Yankees had Sparky Lyle as their closer, and he won the Cy Young Award, and George Steinbrenner awarded him by trading for Goose Gossage to be the closer, and that was the famous Greg Nettles line that Sparky Lyle went from Cy Young to Sayonara. But if you're going to be replaced by somebody, Goose Gossage was a heck of a closer, a really great player, and you know, one of sort of the pioneering of the Hall of Fame closers. And the thing I like about him is he's not a bitter guy. He's one of these guys who has no problem with any of the modern players and doesn't speak. is fine. Now he's was it a couple years ago? He was gonna boycott the Hall of Fame ceremony or something.
Yeah, he's another guy who, closers are too soft these days, and baseball's not respected enough, and somehow it ends up having something to do with Donald Trump, and he's a crank, but that doesn't mean he's not a great pitcher.
And he also got one of the biggest outs in Yankee history, which was in 78 in the one game playoff against Carl Yastrzemski. When Yastrzemski comes up with a chance to let me look it up real quick. But it was I'll just look it up. I won't try and remember it here. So 78, obviously it's the Bucky Dent game. Yankees and Red Sox have to play that one game playoff at Fenway on October 2nd, and let me just bottom of the ninth, Gossage pitching, and Yastrzemski comes up with the Yankees are ahead by one run, and Yastrzemski comes up with runners on first and second. So obviously, a base hit by Yastrzemski at least ties it. An extra base hit, Red Sox win the game and the pennant. Yankees go home, but Gossage gets two future Hall of Famers in a row out. He gets Jim Rice to fly out to right field, and then he gets. Or actually, I'm sorry, no, Burleson's on third here, so it's even more precarious. But he gets Jim Rice to hit a sac fly, and then Carl Yastrzemski to plop out to Nettles at third, and so gets the out in one of the greatest victories in Yankee history against the Red Sox in 1978. I think it's my turn next, and I'm gonna go with number 55, and I think we're gonna stick with Yankee heroes, and we're gonna go with the first great Japanese star of the New York Yankees, the MVP of the 2009 World Series, Hideki Matsui.
Yeah, it's Hideki Matsui, and I'm not going to be able to find the quote quick enough. But Matsui came to the Yankees from Japan, highly touted, highly paid, lots of media coverage in the immediate aftermath of Ichiro, but couldn't have been more different than Ichiro in terms of his demeanor and sort of personality. Ichiro was a little bit of a rock star, or saw himself as a rock star, a little bit of a diva. Certainly didn't, not in a bad way, but certainly didn't suffer from a lack of confidence. Whereas Matsui comes in, and this was seen as a big gamble at the time. It was the 03 Yankees. They were, turning over from the late 90s, early 2000s team everybody liked. The 2002 team was considered a pretty big disappointment. Now they're bringing in guys like Giambi and Matsui. And at the very beginning, he struggles in 03. There was all the article, or the all the stuff in the radio and the newspaper headlines calling him Groundzilla. Because, like, this was the sort of fever pitch of the Yankees in that era, in terms of media coverage, where it was like they had a bad 2 weeks and it was like, oh, this is a disaster. But, sort of gradually grinded it out, turned in, hit that big home run, I want to say, at one point, to kind of catapulted him back into superstardom. Had a big hit in that game seven against Pedro, I believe. But really, the highlight of his career with the Yankees was the 2009 World Series, where he was the MVP of the World Series. Had a huge He had two home runs in game six of that series, the game they clinched the World Series.
Yeah, and he was MVP of the World Series, despite the fact that since he was the DH, he really only played in four of the six, or really only three of the six games. Now he pinch hit in the three games in Philly, but his really the strength of his oh no, I'm sorry, he actually was only one home run, but it was three hits and six RBIs in that game six against Philly. He had a home run in I guess he pinch hit a home run in game three. I don't remember that, but yeah, three home runs and what was it? Six, seven, eight RBIs, and yeah, his monster game six was what got him the MVP trophy. But the reigning last New York Yankee to win win World Series MVP.
Yeah, and then he left after that and was with the where do you go, Tampa after a while.
Angels, then Oakland, then Tampa. He only played 30 or so games with Tampa in 2012.
Okay, yeah, that's right. So, but ultimately ended up, got huge cheers every time he came back to Yankee Stadium. There was really no hard feelings or anything like that. So, just a sort of guy who. Yeah, is he an all-time Yankee great? No. Is he going to be cheered and remembered every time he's back with the Yankees? Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's that clip of him in an Angels uniform getting his World Series ring, and you know, just like you said, just getting a tremendous ovation despite the fact that he was now playing for the other team. I guess it's your turn, and we're going to move on to, I don't know, maybe other than Ruth, the easiest one that we've done.
Yeah, so the next one is the number 56, the New York Giants, Lawrence Taylor, the greatest Giant in franchise history, arguably the greatest defensive player in football history. Mm-hmm. If he's not, he may not be in a class by himself, but it doesn't take too long to call the roll. Giant from 81 to 93, MVP in 1986. I'm going to pull up how many times he was a first team all pro, but I'm going to guess it was most of the 80s. You know, talk about being a guy who transformed a franchise. So first team all pro, 81, 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, second in 87, which again was a strike year, 88, 89, second team all pro in 87 and 90. So from 80 to 90, 81 to 90, he was a first team all pro seven times, including an MVP, and second team all pro twice, or three times rather. The reason the NFL started counting sacks, and just, you know, what else do you need to say? One of the best defensive players of all time.
Yeah, and we've talked before about it, how somehow, I don't know, maybe it's because of some of the off-the-field stuff, maybe it's just because of the nature of defense. You know, you don't necessarily hear LT, you know, when you hear things about sort of the great New York sports icons, and, you know, even, like, the Ruth years, but, like, you know, sort of like pre-war, like, or post-war, rather, like our parents' generation. You hear about Mantle, you hear about Namath, you hear about Messier. You hear about Clyde Frazier, you know, some of these guys. For whatever reason, Lawrence Taylor doesn't necessarily get put in that category, but the fact of the matter is that a New York team, you know, New York had Babe Ruth, New York had Mickey Mantle, New York had Willie Mays for a time, New York had Jackie Robinson, and that's all important to keep in mind, but it's also important to realize that New York had probably the best defensive player in the 100-year history of the NFL.
And I think some of it is he's alive and has not, you know, conducted himself in a way that people want to speak in reverent tones of him when he could be back in the news the next day. Yeah. You know what I mean? Just obviously the best player in, you know, franchise history and one of the best players of all time.
So we're on to 57, and it's my turn to give mine first. I initially had put Mo Lewis, Jets linebacker of the 90s and early 2000s, perhaps most famously known for knocking Drew Bledsoe out of the game and enabling Tom Brady to start his 20-year career as the Patriots starting quarterback. But the more I thought about it, I decided to get away from Lewis. I went with Johan Santana, threw the first no-hitter in Mets history, all-star for the team a couple of times. Didn't really have any great moments, and I don't think he was on any playoff teams. I'm going to double-check that now, but that was where I went. I didn't feel too strongly, but and I guess he only really played 4 years with the Mets, so I don't know. I'd like to hear where you went.
I went with Mo Lewis. I put Santana in parentheses, but I mean, Mo Lewis was there 12 years
Okay.
or 13 years. He was a four-time Pro Bowler, three-time Pro Bowler, once first team All Pro, once second team All Pro. You know, if you think about the era that spans, he was there from 91 to 03. So I don't know how many coaches immediately prior to Parcells, but he would have been there all the way through the Herm Edwards years. He was a starter from day one in 91. He started 15 games in 1991. He started 15 games in 2003. I think Lewis, just by virtue of how much longer, Johan Santana was obviously a long time great player, but not with the Mets. If you're going to give it to Johan Santana, you're giving it to him because of the no-hitter. And then you have to ask yourself, would you have given it to anybody because of the no-hitter?
Yeah, which means you're kind of looking at his pre-Met years.
You're conflict. Yeah, you're. I feel like you have to combine a couple of things that we don't do with other people.
And just because of your curiosity, in those whatever it was, 12 years, 13 years, he played with six Jet coaches: Bruce Coslett, Pete Carroll, Rich Kotite, Bill Parcells, Al Groh, and Herm Edwards. And that doesn't even count the 2 day-long spans of Bill Belichick. So yeah, I can get behind Mo Lewis. Didn't do it. I mean, All Pro once, Pro Bowl once. His best years were those Parcells years when they were really, I guess they only made the playoffs once, but they were really sort of a contender. But yeah, I'm good. We haven't done a lot of, I don't think this might be our first Jet all episode. So yeah, I'm good with Mo Lewis.
All right. 58, I went with Carl
Yep,
Banks.
gonna stay at outside linebacker and go with Carl Banks. Absolutely.
Again, another guy who probably doesn't get the deserve get his just due because he played on the opposite side of Lawrence Taylor. And for a while, the sort of thing was like, well, everybody would look good playing outside of Lawrence Taylor. And it's like, no, not entirely. And you know, he was a first team All Pro at once, only made one Pro Bowl. But again, you have to factor in how many linebackers are going to make the Pro Bowl. They're
Yeah.
going to take LT. You know, they're think about the other defensive players on NFC teams in that era. But you know, was a starter on that 86 team all the way through the 90 team. Was in the 86 playoffs, if you watch like the 49er game and the Redskin game, the two playoff games for the 86 Giants, John Madden cannot stop raving about Carl Banks.
Yeah, talking about how he's become one of the best players in the league. Yep.
Yeah, 9 sacks in 87 in a strike shortened season, 6.5 sacks in 86. You know, and again, you had to play in a defense on the opposite side of Lawrence Taylor. You were going to get a lot of attention by default.
14 tackles in their Super Bowl 21 win over the Denver Broncos.
Yep.
All right, we're on to 59, and it is my turn. And I went with the Jet linebacker of the 80s and 90s, Kyle Clifton. This was one where it was, to be fair, there were not a lot to pick from, but, he was named on the lists that I looked through. Didn't know a ton about the guy, but I'm looking now. Durable guy, played from 84 to 96, which is 13 years, and only missed, it looks like, really didn't miss a single game. Wow. Because he played in 16 games every year but 1987. And in 1987, he played in 12 games, which is all there would have been. So, yeah, he played in every single game. Never a Pro Bowler, never an All Pro. Looks like he led the league in tackles a few times during the early days. So he would have been a part of that New York Sack Exchange team of the mid 80s, even though he was as an inside linebacker, he wasn't going to be one of the guys getting the sacks. In fact, his high for sacks was 2 in 1989. But it seemed like a good guy to have on there, sort of a solid workmanlike guy for the Jets for over a decade.
And I went with him as well. Like you said, not a ton to choose from, but also, you know, a worthy guy for that number.
All right, coming down the home stretch here, we are into the 60s, and you're up to lead us first.
Sure. I went with, and I don't know how to pronounce this, but I'll pronounce it the way I think. I went with Larry Grantham.
I think that's how you pronounce it, yeah.
From the Jets, actually, originally from the New York Titans, was on the team starting with the inception of the franchise in 1960. Linebacker, was on the team all the way through to 72. First team all pro, and you know, you gotta, I always have to remind myself, all pro in those days, that included NFL players too, right?
No, it was separate. It was separate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was separate.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he was first team all AFL, I guess we'll say, in the, now when I pulled up the all pro team from 1960, this has a lot of guys from the, I guess it's all, this is all NFL. Okay, you're right. I'm sorry. It's weird. I pulled up AP one and then it was the NFL one.
Yeah. You got to go over one. Yeah.
First team all pro 60, 61, 62, 63, 64. Second team all pro 65, 67, 68. And then a Pro Bowler again in 69. So he was on the Jet team, the only Jet championship team in 68. Was a starter the whole time he was there. Again, I'm not going to pretend I know a ton about him, but you know, the longevity, was on the team 13 seasons, was one of their best players clearly through the early part of the franchise's history, and you know, was still playing at a high level in the late 60s in the Namath era.
Yeah, I'm surprised, and we may have a few later too, but we don't have a ton of guys from that 68 Jet team. Obviously, we have Namath. And Grantham might actually be the next one. I'm looking at our list here. Yeah, I don't see anybody else from those teams. I'm actually surprised that Grantham is not on the. He's second team. I was looking to see if he was on the 60 to 69 all time AFL team, and he is. He's a backup linebacker on that team. So yeah. Really, I didn't know a lot about the guy either, but I'm impressed, you know, and want to know more. Five-time All-Pro, five-time Pro Bowler on the team all the way from 60 to 72, and, you know, a leader of the, you know, the fact that he is a leader of the best team by far in the history of one of the long-standing New York franchises, I think is probably enough to bolster his case and get him on.
All right. Who did you have for 61?
So 61, I actually was able to get us out of the football and baseball rut. I shouldn't say rut, but the theme. And I went with Rick Nash of the New York Rangers.
I did as well. One of the Rangers from the mid-2010s teams who had some really good years in there. They got to a Stanley Cup Finals and lost to the LA Kings. And then also I think had at least one year where they won the President's Trophy and lost maybe in the Eastern Conference Finals. Nash was a all-star a couple of times. The seasons he was on the Rangers was third in the NFL, third in the NHL in goals in the 2014-2015 season, which I believe was also the year the Kings or also the year they got to the Stanley Cup Finals. They lost in the conference finals to Tampa Bay. But again, not a number with a ton of guys to it. But Nash was, you know, an all-star level player on some good Ranger teams in relatively recent history.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't necessarily realize. And what'd you say his first year was with the Rangers?
Let's see. I just closed it out, but I think like 2013, maybe.
Okay. But yeah, you gotta, you know, like you said, lost the Stanley Cup Finals in 14, lost the seven games to Tampa Bay in 15. Not that I am, you know, a huge Ranger aficionado, but it kind of had slipped my mind that for a couple of years, at least, they were one of the elite teams in the National Hockey League, probably because they didn't actually win a championship. That's probably the reason. And you're right. His first team was 2012-2013 season for the Rangers. So he was getting there just as that era was really starting. So yeah, absent anybody else, I thought Rick Nash was a good selection and a good way to mix it up a little bit.
All right, number 62, I went with Al Atkinson from the Jets. So another 60s, 70s Jet player, another linebacker, actually. He was there for 10 seasons from 65 to 74. So another made the Pro Bowl in 68. So another guy who was another guy who was on that 68 championship team. Again, not a guy I know a ton about, but did you have somebody different?
I actually did. I had a Giants linebacker a Giants lineman by the name of Darryl Dess, who was a 2-time Pro Bowler for the Giants, came to the team in 59 while they were still going to championship games, was on the team through 63, Pro Bowler in 62 and 63 when they were going to their last couple of championship games. Went to the Redskins starting with the 65 season, but actually midway through, or actually only one game into the 66 season. I don't know whether this was a trade or what, ended up back on the Giants and finished his career 66, 67, 68, 69 with the Giants. The two lists that I saw both list Al Atkinson, but with an honorable mention for Darryl Dess. I just want to look at Atkinson's career stats real quick here. Like you said, 65 to 74. So he's a 1-time Pro Bowler, but he wins the Super Bowl. You know, I could probably go with Atkinson just because of the specialness of that championship team, but it's close, I would say.
Yeah, I went with Atkinson, but like you said, I don't feel particularly strong about it. All right, we up to 1963 here.
Well, not 1963.
So 63, excuse me.
Yeah, no, I'll go with Atkinson for 62, and it's my turn for 63, and I went with Carl Nelson. Giants offensive tackle on their first Super Bowl team, actually right after the 86 season was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease and missed some time. Did he really only play he played no time in the NFL. Good God. He was on the team. He only came back in 88 and played 9 games. I thought maybe he had a little bit more longevity than that. I don't know. Who did you have?
I went with Doug Van Horn just because Nelson did not play a long time. And Van Horn was there for about 10 years, I think 11 years with the Giants, pretty much the 70s. So not the sterling era of Giants football. And he, you know, didn't make a Pro Bowl or anything like that. But Nelson, I looked, I was like, that's really not a long time.
Yeah, Doug Van Horn started his career with a season with the Detroit Lions before going to the Giants starting in the 68 season. And yeah, doesn't make any Pro Bowls, but he's there for over a decade. Yeah, if you want to make the argument that even with a championship game or a championship with the Giants in 86, if you want to make the argument that 3 years is 3 or 4 years is basically not enough, I can do that. I can give you Doug Van Horn for that one.
Yeah, you gotta be something real special in those 3 or 4 years, in my opinion, to be there.
Yep, I get that. All right, we got 4 left here, and you're up for number 64.
All right, which is fitting because that was my number all through high school and college, through high school and Pop Warner before that. So I'm glad it's 64. I went with Jim Burt, the defensive lineman for the Giants from 81 to 87 or 88, was traded to San Francisco, or left for San Francisco, and was there in 89 and won a championship. So was not on the 90 Giant team. But Burt was another guy who probably his best year was 86, started in the middle on that 3-4, that 3-4 Giants team, you know, 84, 85, 86, really, really good player. Pro Bowl in 86. Not a ton of stats for a guy who's, you know, biggest job was going to be filling the middle and occupying blockers and freeing up those linebackers to make all those plays. But I thought the other guy I looked at was John Mendenhall, but I just looking at Burt's career, I thought was just more impressive overall than Mendenhall as an offensive lineman for the Giants for 8 years.
Yeah. I had Burt
defensive lineman.
I had Burt too. I think the fact that he kind of epitomized the blue collar mentality of the 86 Giants with the jersey too tight and, you know, the six and the four, you know, a foot and a half away on his chest. I went with Burt also for 64.
Yeah.
And then for 65, I sort of flipped it around and went from the nose tackle in 86 to the center in 86 and went with Bart Oates, who I think maybe gets a little bit underrated. He's the only guy who was a part of the starting offensive line for both the 86 and the 90 Giants teams. And I don't know. Let me look at these two articles here to see if anybody else went anywhere else. They did.
Went and won another championship for good measure, too.
With those 49er teams.
That counts for this, but.
Yeah, no, and he was on the Giants for a long time, too. He was there. Started, was he might have even been a, I think he was a USFL guy, Bart Oates.
Yeah, it says he came into the league in 85 at 27 years old.
Yeah,
so
I think he was a USFL guy. And you know he wasn't going, you know he wasn't late because he was getting a law degree because he did that while he was playing. So I think, yeah, and I'm pretty sure he was a USFL guy. Yeah, was with the Giants all the way to that first Dan Reeves year where they were good and made the playoffs. And then after that, when the Giants decided that they didn't have any interest in being good under Dan Reeves, he was one of the guys who left. Made two more Pro Bowls in 94 and 95 in his last 2 years with the Niners. And like you said, was the center on the Steve Young 49er team that won the Super Bowl in 1994. Five-time Pro Bowler, three with the Giants. Guy made three Pro Bowlers at 35 and over, which is pretty impressive.
Well, the other thing you got to remember with that too, and I'm not going to look into who a specific player was, but there was probably the reason he didn't make a Pro Bowl till 1990. There was probably two well-established centers who just, they got voted into the Pro Bowl every year. And if one of them retired, he probably just suddenly had a spot open up.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of who that would be, but maybe somebody on the Redskins probably or something like that. So
that was my thought.
Actually, just give me a second to look that up. You got me curious. And let's be honest, how often do we talk about offensive linemen not here on this podcast? So we can indulge for a second. Starting center for the NFC was Jay Hilgenberg for Chicago, who was a Pro Bowler every year from 85 to 91. So that's at least a part of it, I would imagine.
All right, we got two left, right?
Yeah, and I think we're probably going to stay on the offensive line for number 66, too.
I went with David Deal.
Me too.
They mentioned William Roberts, and they mentioned Randy Rasmussen. But Deal, another one who was on – he was the starting left tackle on both of those Giant teams that won the Super Bowl against the Patriots. That line, three of the five guys were the same. They actually going into 2011 had made kind of a couple of big changes, but left tackle being, you know, he wasn't ever their best offensive lineman, but he was the left tackle, which is obviously the guy who protects the quarterback's blind side, played some guard later on in his career. And again, that was particularly the line of that 07 team. That 07 team that was, O'Hara and Snee and him and McKenzie was the next team.
No, McKenzie was 07.
McKenzie was. So McKenzie, just the sort of consistent offensive line for a number of years on that team, and Deal was a big part of that.
Yeah, all five guys, Deal, Soibert, O'Hare, Snee, McKenzie in 07, played all 16 games, which is huge.
Mm-hmm. So I have him. And then we got, what, one more tonight?
Yeah, we got one more. We're going to close with number 67, and I think we're going to stay on the offensive line, and we're going to stay with, at least for me, I don't know, you obviously have a say in this too, but I went with Dave Herman, who was, and I'm looking here at the Athletic article. Apparently he was a guard, but moved to right tackle right before Super Bowl III to protect Joe Namath from the Bubba Smith of the Baltimore Colts. Herman, another one of these guys, played his whole career with the Jets, got there in 64, which I think was 64 Namath's first year too, or was Namath was 65, but he got there in 64, sort of just as things were heating up, was a Pro Bowl in 68 and 69, which was the two times that they made the playoffs, I believe, during the Namath years. So another one of these Jets guys who came into his prime just as they were becoming the 68 Jets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny, we're getting a lot of representation. As we've gotten into the 60s, we've gotten a lot of representation from those 68 Jet teams.
Yeah, we really, really did. We had Herman at 67. We had Atkinson at 62. We had Larry Grantham at 60. Yeah, we hadn't had a Jet until Mo Lewis at 57. But then we had them at 57, 59, 60, 62, and 67. And all I can say is, bro, the Jets.
And I'm sure we might have at least one more, you know, maybe not from that era, but we're probably not done with the – I mean, look, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it's all going to be carried by the football team. So
yeah, no, I'm just looking here, and I don't see I see a couple of hockey, not a ton of hockey, but and then I see there's the 90s will have at least one baseball player, I guess. We can we don't want to spoil things, but we can. So yeah, so this was fun. Let me just run through it real quick. And I'm not going to give the numbers, but we're starting with 34, so you guys can follow along. Charles Oakley, Mike Richter, Don Newcomb, Casey Stengel, Rick Aguilera, Roy Campanella, Joe Morrison, Tom Seaver, Mariano Rivera, R.A. Dickey, Reggie Jackson, Emlyn Tennell, Andy Pettit, Jesse Orosco, Jacob deGrom, Ron Guidry, Ken Strong, Bernie Williams, C.C. Sabathia, Harry Carson, Goose Gossage, Hideki Matsui, Lawrence Taylor, Mo Lewis, Carl Banks, Kyle Clifton, Larry Grantham, Rick Nash, Al Atkinson, Doug Van Horn, Jim Burt, Bart Oates, David Deal, and Dave Herman. This was fun. I think in some ways, you know, the first one was probably, you know, more a lot more history to get into from 1 to 33, but This was kind of cool. And I guess the only thing I would say is that I'm not going to go back and count it, but there were how many guys, you know, 10 to 15 that we would consider all-time greats on the first episode. Really, other than Taylor, there's nobody else that you would consider an all-time great on this list.
Not to the level of the Yankees from the single-digit era. Yeah, well, Rivera
is the other one too, but even like on the level of like a Messier or even like a Willis Reed, you know, there's nobody really, you know, I mean, obviously Willie Mays, although that's, you know, he didn't play his whole career, you know, Brodeur at number 30. This is definitely a lot of sort of either rank and file guys who just were, you know, solid pros, or a few guys who were, you know, perennial Pro Bowlers, that type of thing. But, you know, not a ton of like, oh my God, this guy's an all-time great type of thing.
That's true.
All right. Well, this was fun. We got one more to come probably at some point, late spring, early summer. And we enjoyed this. So I think until we'll be back with something different, I think probably the next episode that you all hear about after this is that gets pushed out is going to be us talking about 1880s baseball. So it's always something different on the Hello Old Sport podcast. But we appreciate you guys listening. And until next time, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
It is time to bring back the game that teaches players how to think. Modern youth soccer is more organized than ever, yet many young players are missing one of the most powerful development tools in the game, unstructured free play. The importance of unstructured free play, coaching with a street soccer mentality, challenges coaches, parents, and player development leaders to rethink how young athletes learn. Drawing from decades of coaching experience, child development principles, and the timeless lessons of street soccer, author Giovanni Pacini shows why creativity, decision-making, resilience, joy, and soccer IQ grow when players are given space to explore the game. The Importance of Unstructured Free Play, Coaching with a Street Soccer Mentality, is a book for grassroots coaches, youth soccer directors, parents, educators, and anyone who believes that player development should produce more than organized drill followers. It offers a practical approach for balancing structure with freedom using guided learning, constraints, small-sided games, reflection, and activity designs that let the game be the ultimate teacher. Order your copy of The Importance of Unstructured Free Play, Coaching with a Street Soccer Mentality on Amazon today.